Coming up, Deborah Potter on denominations that use their economic power to pressure Israel to end its occupation of Palestinian territories. And Kim Lawton visits the Children's Museum of Indianapolis, where a unique exhibit has been helping young people learn about faith traditions different from their own. Plus, the Islamic practice of washing before daily prayers. One imam says it's preparing for an appointment with God.
Major funding for Religion and Ethics News Weekly is provided by the Lilly Endowment, an Indianapolis-based private family foundation dedicated to its founders' interest in religion, community development, and education. Additional funding also provided by Mutual of America, designing customized individual and group retirement products. That's why we're your retirement company.
Welcome, I'm Bob Abernethy. It's good to have you with us. This week brought an historic moment in the thousand-year-old divide between Eastern and Western Christianity. On his way to Mexico for a five-day visit, Pope Francis stopped in Cuba, where he met with the leader of the Russian Orthodox Church, Patriarch Kirill. It was the first official meeting between a pope and a Russian Orthodox patriarch since the Great Schism of 1054. Joining me with more on this is managing editor Kim Lawton. Kim, we don't every day get a thousand-year-old story to look at.
Exactly. It's nice to have a development after a millennium. But, you know, this is a big deal. And people, popes have been hoping for some kind of step, better relations with the Russian church for a really long time. John Paul II really wanted to go to Russia and had hoped to do that, but certainly with all the tensions in the Cold War, that never happened. So now for Francis to meet with the leader of the Russian Orthodox Church, they talk about Christian unity. Francis has met with the Orthodox Patriarch, the Ecumenical Patriarch Bartholomew, who's the spiritual leader of the world's Orthodox churches. But the Russian leader has not been open in the past to such meetings. And Russia actually represents the largest number of Orthodox Christians around the world. Some say as many as two-thirds of all Orthodox Christians are Russian Orthodox.
And what's at the top of the agenda?
Well, they said that their mutual concern about the persecution of Christians in the Middle East and North Africa is what finally brought them together. And they certainly, in many places of the world, Christians have been under siege. Some have been leaving lands where Christianity has been for a long time. And the majority of those Christians who are feeling that pressure are either Roman Catholic or Orthodox, although certainly others as well. So that was the main reason, but some theological issues as well.
Theological and also political in Francis's visit to Mexico.
Well, politics is always in the background, right? And, you know, Francis has proven to be a very able player on the world stage. So he's got this big moment in the church. Some say that the patriarch is very close to Putin, and so who knows what kind of Russian geopolitics may also be affected by this meeting. But yes, and Francis is in Mexico, where he's continuing some of his themes about concern for the poor, peace, and immigration.
Yeah. Kim Lawton, our managing editor, many thanks. In other news, Bishop Michael Curry, the first African-American presiding bishop of the Episcopal Church, addressed the National Press Club in Washington this week. He said the church will not change its positions on gay issues, even though it was sanctioned by the wider Anglican Communion for allowing clergy to perform same-sex marriages.
We as the Episcopal Church, we are certainly committed to the Anglican Communion. We are equally committed to being a church that is a house of prayer for all people.
As religious groups continue to help residents of Flint, Michigan by distributing supplies, Democratic presidential candidate Hillary Clinton spoke at a church there about the lead poisoning that's affected thousands of children.
What happened in Flint is immoral. The children of Flint are just as precious as the children of any other part of America.
Clinton and other Democratic leaders are pushing for Congress to approve hundreds of millions of dollars in federal aid to help end the public health crisis in Flint. A 17-member commission established in 2013 by Pope Francis to help combat child sex abuse announced it had voted that one of its members take a leave of absence. Peter Saunders is one of two sexual abuse survivors on the Pontifical Commission for the Protection of Minors. Saunders has been critical of the commission and what he describes as its slow pace. In response to growing anti-Islamic rhetoric, the U.S. Conference of Catholic Bishops has announced that it is launching a new National Catholic Muslim Dialogue Group. Chicago Archbishop Blaise Supich is slated to lead the initiative. It's expected to launch in January of next year. The professor at an evangelical Christian college who created controversy by wearing a hijab announced she's leaving the school. The professor had also noted on social media that Muslims and Christians worship the same God. LaRisha Hawkins has been a tenured political science professor at Wheaton College. The school had initially moved to fire Hawkins, but later announced it would drop the termination proceedings. We have a special report today on a movement among some American Protestant denominations to use their economic power, such as pension funds, to pressure Israel to end its occupation of the West Bank. Last summer, the United Church of Christ became the second major denomination to do just that. Those voting insist that being against Israeli government policies does not mean they are against the existence of Israel itself. Support for our story was provided by the Pulitzer Center for Crisis Reporting. Our reporter is Deborah Potter.
The targets are companies doing business in the Israeli-occupied West Bank. Last summer, the United Church of Christ became the latest Protestant denomination to divest from those companies, including Caterpillar and Hewlett-Packard.
The human rights abuses that have been occurring in the occupied territories for so long are, in fact, wrong. And if I keep silent, I am complicit.
I don't think that we here today are in a position to choose sides. We have not walked in the sandals or shoes of the Jews or Palestinians.
Motion carries as amended.
In the end, the vote was overwhelmingly in favor of divestment. As a practical matter, the resolution means that church pension funds will no longer hold stock in companies doing business in occupied territories.
Our clients want to invest in a way that they are spiritually comfortable with. So we have the opportunity to create portfolios that are in line with the way they view their lives.
One of the attractions of this strategy is that we're not just a relatively small Christian community in the United States taking an action. We're joining a much broader movement, and it amplifies the weight of our action.
The movement is called BDS, short for Boycott, Divestment, and Sanctions, launched a decade ago by more than 100 Palestinian organizations. They called for international economic action to pressure Israel to withdraw from occupied territories.
Investment managers have the ability to buy any security.
Churches have been debating the question ever since, and in 2014, the Presbyterian Church USA became the first major denomination to approve divestment by a margin of just 7 votes.
The vote passes by 51% to 49%. Even though we have affirmed our Palestinian brothers and sisters in this vote, in no way is this a reflection of our lack of love for our Jewish sisters and brothers.
That's not how many Israelis see it. In their view, the BDS effort ignores continuing Palestinian attacks on Israel and is, at its heart, anti-Semitic.
BDS is not about political pressure. It's a moral statement that you are a pariah state, that morally you don't deserve to be. You're not part of the human family. You're not deserving to be there as a partner in that human dialogue till you transform your ways.
The Presbyterian Church has a long history of denouncing anti-Semitism. We're all about talking to one another, to our neighbors, even to our enemies. That's our biblical mandate. So dialogue is critical to us. We don't want dialogue to be a substitute for action.
For churches, deciding whether to take economic action aimed at Israel is viewed as a moral choice. Both supporters and opponents of divestment believe they've chosen the best available option to achieve the same goal, justice and peace.
John Wimberly is a Presbyterian minister who opposes divestment.
I've become convinced from Palestinian friends, mostly, who've told me this, that what we're doing when we pursue divestment is we are empowering the most extreme voices and the harshest voices on both sides of the wall.
What we want to do is to say you don't need to take a violent path. There are these nonviolent tools that we can use collectively to bring about the change we all seek.
Divestment supporters compare their efforts to the anti-apartheid campaign against South Africa that helped to end white minority rule.
So help me God.
No analogy is perfect, but there is a situation of separateness and unequalness in Israel and Palestine. There is also a parallel, a hopeful parallel, in that economic measures were used to change the dynamic in South Africa, and we're hopeful they can be used here as well.
With confidence in the power of the...
Susan Wilder, a Presbyterian minister, took part in this joint Christmas service at Washington National Cathedral and an Evangelical Lutheran church in Bethlehem. Wilder's support for divestment is in part a response to what's known as the Kairos-Palestine document, issued 6 years ago by Palestinian Christian leaders.
This statement really crystallizes the plea that the United Church of Christ heard when it took its action. Our question to our brothers and sisters in the churches today is, are you able to help us get our freedom back? For this is the only way you can help the two peoples attain justice, peace, security, and love.
I'm not questioning the sincerity of those who are doing this, but I'm basically questioning the judgment. In the end, it's hard to convince Israelis there's a price for their policies if it looks like it's one-sided.
Ambassador Dennis Ross, who spent years as a U.S. envoy trying to negotiate a Middle East peace, says the real goal of many Palestinian organizers is to deny Israel's right to exist.
The BDS movement itself has been about no Israel. It's not about two states. When it says peace, it's about peace because there's no Israel. Many of the faith-driven movements think that they are pursuing a cause that is just, because it's about ending an occupation of Palestinians, not about ending an occupation of Palestinians at the expense of Israel's existence.
Denominations that have voted to divest insist they support Israel's right to exist, while opposing what they see as mistreatment of Palestinians. But when the Presbyterians meet next year, a proposal for a one-state solution will likely be on the table.
There are extremes on both sides that want one state. There are Orthodox extremists in Israel who want one Jewish state. And there are people in the Palestinian community who want one Palestinian state. And so I think we would just be unleashing awful forces if we did that.
Other Protestant denominations are still wrestling with divestment. The Episcopal Church voted it down last year, while calling for more positive engagement, dialogue, and reconciliation. The United Methodist Church also voted against divestment at its most recent general conference, but its pension fund has dropped five Israeli banks from its portfolio. In the meantime, churches that have decided to divest concede their impact is likely to be limited.
The movement for divestment here was more an act of witness of hope to the Palestinians than it is an understanding that this will lead to the sanctions, to the outcry, that will bring about change for Palestinians on the ground.
Supporters believe divestment sends a clear and much-needed signal to Palestinians that they are not alone. But critics worry that if mainline churches become identified with just one side, it will undermine their efforts to be peace brokers in the region. For Religion and Ethics News Weekly, I'm Deborah Potter in Washington.
The U.S. is one of the most religiously diverse nations in the world. Because of that diversity and the fear that it can bring, Many experts believe it's important that children learn about different faith traditions, even at a young age. But that can be controversial. There are few public forums where the issue is addressed for children. Kim Lawton visited the Children's Museum of Indianapolis, which has been featuring a unique exhibit about religion that's been well received.
This is the Children's Museum of Indianapolis, the largest children's museum in the world. It's a place for fun, but the museum has also addressed some difficult subjects, including the Holocaust, segregation, and AIDS. For the past few months, the museum has taken on yet another potentially controversial subject, world religions.
We knew when we started planning this that not many places are willing to even tackle a conversation about religion, and so it would be challenging. We wanted, on the one hand, to talk about religion without telling people what they should believe or even that they should believe.
The Sacred Journeys exhibit is a partnership with National Geographic, funded by the Lilly Endowment. It follows children and families of several faiths as they participate in religious pilgrimages and rituals. In addition to covering religious history and culture, the exhibit explores contemporary beliefs and practices, topics rarely addressed by other museums, especially those for children.
We wanted children to not only understand what they maybe learn in Sunday school, but to also know why that girl down the block dresses the way she does, why that boy in school was off for the holiday he was off for. What people believe and how they practice what they believe influences what people do all over the world, and it influences the people in your neighborhood.
Now, this really large cube is called the Kaaba, and it's covered in a silk cloth called a Kiswa. Can you guys say that with me?
Kiswa.
Very good.
The Sacred Journeys exhibit includes loaned artifacts such as fabric from the Kaaba in Mecca, a throne built for the Dalai Lama, pieces from a Gutenberg Bible and the Dead Sea Scrolls, a stone from the Western Wall in Jerusalem, Jewish objects taken into space by Indiana astronaut David Wolf, a replica of the Shroud of Turin, and the Hindu deity Ganesh. Buddhist monks created a mandala, an intricate geometric design made from multicolored grains of sand. In the Buddhist tradition, mandalas are eventually destroyed as a demonstration of the impermanence of life. As a result of immigration, experts say in the last 50 years, the U.S. has become one of the most religiously diverse countries in history.
In 1965, we opened up the door to people from every country, every religion, every tradition, every culture, and that has created a vibrant period of American life, but it's not been an easy one, and that creates the fear and anxiety. People are a little afraid of religion and diversity and change that's happening so rapidly.
Prominent religion scholar Raymond Williams from Wabash College headed an interfaith group of advisors for the exhibit. He says fear and ignorance are why more education is needed.
You can't build a democracy or free society or a civic life on fear and hatred. It has to be built on knowledge and hope.
Many children learn about their own faith tradition in their family's congregations or in religious schools, but there are not a lot of forums where they can learn about other religions. Rabbi Sandy Sasso, Director of Religion, Spirituality, and the Arts at Butler University, was another advisor.
We are so afraid in public school to touch the subject of religion for fear that we're proselytizing, and there's a legitimate concern there. However, we can't really understand our culture or our civilization without understanding religion.
Some public schools are teaching about religion, although rarely at the elementary level. Other curriculums have generated controversy because of parental fears that they favor one religion or are too critical of another. It may be tricky, but experts say religion can successfully be addressed in a public arena, as long as constitutional prohibitions against advancing a particular religion are strictly followed.
Public schools, government, cannot teach or force people into a religious belief or practice. And so the public schools can teach about religion, but they can't propagate a particular religion. And the line between that is fairly narrow.
Sasso has written several best-selling children's books about religion. She argues the topic can and should be addressed at a very early age.
All children have an innate spirituality, and they like to ask the big questions. It's really we who are adults who are afraid of those questions. Children are not.
One of Sasso's books is about Anne Frank. She strongly believes children are able to handle even difficult themes like the Holocaust.
It's very important for children to be able to confront these difficult issues because they do confront these difficult issues. They see what's happening around the world on the news.
She says that includes looking at commonalities between faiths, but not shying away from the differences.
Sometimes I fear that in order to try to teach tolerance, that we say we're all alike and we forget to acknowledge our distinctions. And it is in acknowledging our differences and celebrating those differences that we come to better understand one another and ultimately live together in a more harmonious way.
The goal of mutual understanding is why teachers from Trinity Lutheran School in Indianapolis brought their students to the Sacred Journeys exhibit.
If we come from a place of understanding where other people come from, it helps us to be able to work together to help improve society and all the things that we find important to us.
If the big questions of my life are addressed by my faith, then how could I not want to understand those questions and how people grapple with them in other faiths?
Education, Sasso says, helps counter stereotypes about others that are often highlighted in the media.
If children have not learned anything about Islam or about Judaism, then how are they going to respond to that? They have no basis in which to counter those statements.
Officials at the Children's Museum say they've been surprised by the positive reception the Sacred Journeys exhibit has received.
We sort of went into this expecting the worst might happen, that people would not be willing to learn about others' faiths. And what we've experienced in many ways is the best. We know from our evaluations that the conversations continue once the families go home.
After the exhibit closes later this month, it will travel to the Mayborn Museum at Baylor University. Several other museums across the country have contacted officials here asking for advice about how they too can tackle religion. I'm Kim Lawton in Indianapolis.
Finally, belief and practice. One of the five pillars of Islam is that Muslims pray five times a day. Before those prayers, they're expected to perform a purification ritual called wudu, during which they wash their face, hands, arms, and feet. We visited a mosque in Washington, D.C., Masjid Muhammad, where Imam Talib Sharif described the cleansing practice and its religious significance.
Allahu Akbar, Allahu Akbar.
Each day we pray is like we have an established appointment before God. And just like if you have some important appointments, you want to make sure that you're clean. We want to represent our best before our Creator. So the first thing, when it's time for prayer, we say, am I clean? That cleanliness is a process. It starts with your intentions. In basic terms, it's I intend to make the ablution in preparation to stand in obedience before my Lord. The first thing you do after you make your intentions is you actually wash your hands. Make sure your hands are clean before you start to begin the ritual washing. He's going to begin by washing the right hand three times, and then the left hand three times. My actions are motivated spiritually, mentally, and then also physically. So that's what the three times represents. Now he's gonna wash his mouth three times. I need my mouth to be clean. So it would be consistent with my actions. And I wouldn't do something and say something else. The Quran says our life should be in agreement with what we say. And then he's gonna wash his nose, and that'll be followed by the whole face three times. So now he's going through a process. We think, we act, we defend, we seek to purify ourselves in our spirit. This time he's gonna focus on just the arms and not the hands, just do the right arm first and then the left arm. Okay. And now he's just gonna wipe over his hair from the front to the back, and then he's gonna clean out both ears, and then now he'll be going from there to the feet. He's gonna do the right foot first, up to the ankle three times. And he's gonna go to the left also three times. He would make just a small prayer, asking God to give him light, bless him to shine. That completes the ritual washing called wudu. There's a common expression that said cleanliness is next to godliness. This is a part of what's in the spirit of what came from the prophet, peace be upon him, and what the Quran also gives us about being clean.
That's our program for now. I'm Bob Abernethy. You can follow us on Twitter and Facebook and watch us anytime on the PBS app for iPhones and iPads. There's also much more on our website where you can listen to or watch every program. Join us at pbs.org/religionethics. As we leave you, scenes from Ash Wednesday this past week. Many Western Christians received a mark of ashes on the holy day as a symbol of penitence and a reminder of human mortality.
Major funding for Religion and Ethics News Weekly is provided by the Lilly Endowment, an Indianapolis-based private family foundation dedicated to its founders' interest in religion, community development, and education. Additional funding also provided by Mutual of America, designing customized individual and group retirement products. That's why we're your retirement company.
Be more. PBS.